chapter 7. There was straw scattered on the floor over a layer of rushes. There was an open log fire, sputtering and blazing in a large fireplace. There were a few chickens, strutting and pecking on the floor. There were seats with hand-embroidered cushions on them, and there were tapestries covering the windows and the doors. Richard stumbled forward as the train lurched out of the station. He reached out, grabbed hold of the nearest person, and regained his balance. The nearest person happened to be a short, grey, elderly man-at-arms, who would have looked, Richard decided, exactly like a recently retired government employee, were it not for the tin hat, the surcoat, the rather clumsily knitted chainmail, and the spear. Instead, he looked like a recently retired government employee who had, somewhat against his will, been dragooned into his local amateur dramatic society where he had been forced to play a man-at-arms. The little grey man blinked short-sightedly at Richard as Richard grabbed him, and then he said, lugubriously, "Sorry about that."
"My fault," said Richard.
"I know," said the man.
An enormous Irish wolfhound padded down the aisle and stopped beside a lute player who sat on the floor, picking at a gladsome melody in a desultory fashion. The wolfhound glared at Richard, snorted with disdain, then lay down and went to sleep. At the far end of the carriage, an elderly falconer with a hooded falcon on his wrist was exchanging pleasantries with a small knot of damosels of a certain age. Some passengers obviously stared at the four travellers, others just as obviously ignored them. It was, Richard realised, as if someone had taken a small medieval court and put it, as best they could, in one carriage of an underground train. A herald raised his bugle to his lips and played a tuneless blast as an immense elderly man in a huge fur-lined dressing gown and carpet slippers staggered through the connecting door to the next compartment, his arm resting on the shoulder of a jester in shabby motley. The old man was larger than life in every way. He wore an eye patch over his left eye, which had the effect of making him look slightly helpless and unbalanced, like a one-eyed hawk. There were fragments of food in his red-grey beard, and what appeared to be pajama pants were visible at the bottom of his shabby fur gown. "That," thought Richard, correctly, "must be the Earl." The Earl's jester, an elderly man with a pinched, humourless mouth and a painted face, looked like he had fled from a life as an all-round entertainer near the bottom of the bill on the Victorian music halls 100 years before. He led the Earl to a throne-like carved wooden seat, in which, a trifle unsteadily, the Earl sat down. The wolfhound got up, padded down the length of the carriage, and settled itself at the Earl's slippered feet.
"Earl's Court," thought Richard.
"Of course." And then he began to wonder whether there was a baron in Baron's Court tube station, or a raven in Raven's Court, or... The little old man-at-arms coughed asthmatically and said,
"Right then, you lot, state your business."
Dor stepped forward. She held her head up high, suddenly seeming taller and more at ease than Richard had previously seen her, and she said,
"We seek an audience with His Grace, the Earl."
The Earl called down the carriage.
"What did the little girl say, Halvard?"
he asked. Richard wondered if he were deaf.
Halvard, the elderly man-at-arms, shuffled around and cupped his hand to his mouth.
They seek an audience, Your Grace," he shouted
over the rattle of the train. The Earl pushed aside his thick fur cap and scratched his head meditatively. He was balding underneath his cap.
"They do? An audience? How splendid! Who are they, Halvard?"
Halvard turned back to them.
"He wants to know who you all are. Keep it short, though. Don't go on."
"I am the Lady Dor," announced Dor. "The Lord Portico was my father."
The Earl brightened at this, leaned forward, peered through the smoke with his one good eye.
"Did she say she was Portico's oldest girl?" he asked the jester.
"Yes, Your Grace,"